Come on in, we're gonna get started in a second. Hello, I'm Larry Jacobs. I am a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. I want to welcome you to our ongoing series of public conversations about our political world and public policy. Today, we have a terrific presentation and conversation. But before we get to that, I want to just let you know that we want you to be involved in this conversation. It's an important part of what we're going to be doing over the next hour. You'll see at the bottom of the screen there's a Q&A button, and we're going to get to as many questions as possible. And I'm just going to let you know, we've got a bias for questions that raise new issues, new questions, and may be challenging. Really excited today to welcome Suzanne Mettler. And just to be fully disclosed, Suzanne and I are good friends, we're co-authors, and we've known each other for a number of years, so this is a particular pleasure. But I've also got to let you know that Suzanne Mettler is a very distinguished faculty and scholar. She is the Clinton Rossiter Professor at Cornell University. She's published 5 books, including Submerged State, which was published in my book series at the University of Chicago. Most of the books that she's published have won distinguished awards because they are so outstanding. So this is really a very accomplished scholar. In addition to these books, Suzanne has published the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, and other kind of more public outlets. She is a powerful public intellectual. Today we're going to be talking about Suzanne Mettler's book with Robert Lieberman at Johns Hopkins University. The title of the book is Four Threats, the Recurring Crises of American Democracy. Professor Mettler, so good to have you with us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for welcoming me back to the Humphrey School. I, of course, wish I was there with you all in person, but I'm very thankful for this Zoom environment that offers the next best thing for us these days. So thank you all for coming today. So I wanted to tell you briefly how this book came about. I, at Cornell, teach a big class on Intro to American Politics, a big lecture class for undergraduates. I had taught this class when I was an assistant professor just out of grad school at Syracuse University back in the 1990s. Then I didn't teach it for a long time, came back to it around 2012 at Cornell. And it was like teaching about a different country because so much had changed in the meanwhile. And we had growing polarization and declining trust in government and a lot of dysfunction. And so I felt like I was having to run to keep up with teaching the course. And then we got to the election of 2016. And while this was going on, I found it extremely challenging because even topics that had been long established, like the legitimacy of American elections and the fact that, you know, most Americans would respect the results, and topics like freedom of the press were coming into question. And I was finding myself, you know, really perplexed. And it was at that point that I would find myself in conversations with other political scientists in my department who study countries around the world and the decline of democracy and what makes that happen. And when I would talk to them, they seemed to have a lot of insight about the United States, and it was very disturbing. They would say, well, you know, when we look at Donald Trump as a candidate, he reminds us of leaders we've seen in Venezuela and Peru and Turkey and Hungary. And they would say, you know, democracies, they don't last forever. They come and they go. And the United States has had a pretty good run. For me, as a scholar of American politics, this was mind-bending. And I felt that I needed to learn more from them. So in 2017, a group of us formed what we call the American Democracy Collaborative. It's scholars who look at democratic deterioration worldwide, as well as some of us who study American history in politics, to try to understand better what the United States is going through today. And this book, Four Threats, emerged out of that. So now let me step back and set the scene for you. Political polarization had been growing for years. Each action by one camp provoked an even greater counterreaction from the opponents. Then the president signed a law that made it more difficult for immigrants to attain American citizenship and easier to deport people who were deemed to be dangerous or from hostile nations. He signed another law that allowed for the prosecution of journalists who openly criticized his administration. Each were efforts to weaken the political opposition. The year was not 2017 or 2020, rather it was 1798, and President John Adams had just signed the Alien and Sedition Acts. Adams' emergent party, the Federalists, defended the acts as essential for national security. Or as one congressman put it, there was no need to invite hordes of wild Irishmen, nor the turbulent and disorderly of all the world, to come here with a basic view to distract our tranquility. Indeed, no sooner was the ink dry on the US Constitution than Americans became deeply polarized. Public officials led the way. James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, for example, helped states governed by their emerging opposition party, the Democratic Republicans, to refuse to recognize the Alien and Sedition Acts. Ordinary Americans, too, took sides. Federalists and Republicans often resided in different neighborhoods and attended different churches. They each took on their own ways of demonstrating their patriotism, and sometimes violence ensued. As the decade proceeded, the conflicts intensified and the stakes grew higher. Political leaders had not developed the concept of legitimate political opposition, that groups could take different approaches to governing and compete with each other routinely through the political process. Politics took on the proportions of mortal combat because people believed the very survival of the young nation was at stake. Many Americans worried that monarchy might reassert itself, or aristocracy would replace representative government, or that some states might secede from the Union and cause its demise. The point is that early American democracy was fragile. The overarching question for our book is whether we should also be worried today. Is American democracy genuinely in peril? Now, there are sound reasons, even now, to think that it is not. We have the oldest constitution in the world, complete with its system of checks and balances, intended to fragment power. The United States is wealthy, and that's a factor that makes the loss of democracy unlikely. In addition, while the nation in the 1790s included institutions that repudiated democracy, most notably slavery, and it did not become a full democracy, I would argue, until the 1960s and 1970s, it is still fair to say that democracy has progressed over time, becoming more robust and inclusive. And also, if we look around today, it has many features of strength: two well-established political parties, each with control of different parts of the federal government and many states, and active citizens who this year voted at the highest rates since 1900 in the presidential election, which is extraordinary. And we have active news organizations. So all of these reasons make democracy today appear to be secure. On the other hand, it's not unreasonable to wonder whether democracy may be at the risk of deteriorating or backsliding. As we've learned from those who study democratic deterioration in other nations, these days we don't tend to see democracy taken at the barrel of a gun, or canceled elections, or the disbanding of the legislature. Rather, it tends to happen in more subtle ways. Typically, elections are still held, and yet democracy decays, such that a nation becomes a hybrid with some democratic features but not others, what some scholars call competitive authoritarianism. In other words, we shouldn't be thinking of democracy having an on-off switch of democracy versus not democracy, but rather as a continuum. And the question is, at any point in time, whether we're moving toward becoming more of a full, robust democracy or backsliding in the direction of autocracy. So that's what we take on in this book. And we look at five earlier periods in American history when Americans were broadly worried about backsliding. And we look at what happened then, and then we analyze the contemporary period in light of what we've learned. Now, I should say by democracy, what we mean is a system of representative government with accountability to citizens. And there's four basic pillars that make this work. They are free and fair elections, the rule of law, the legitimacy of the opposition, and the integrity of rights, meaning civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights. And these four features are the indicators that we look at in each of the five periods to see whether democracy is really under threat and deteriorating or not. And we've also learned from those who study democracy around the world that there are four key threats that make it vulnerable. The first of these is political polarization. Now, democracy works well when there are multiple groups and identities in a society such that people have overlapping affiliations and memberships. So for example, you might belong to one political party or the other, but in your place of work or in your place of worship or in civic organizations you belong to, you regularly interact with people of the other political party. What's problematic is when these differences increasingly sort themselves out and align so that it becomes like we're in two camps of us versus them. And when that happens, politics ceases to be a process involving negotiation and accommodation, and it can start to feel like opponents are instead our enemies. The second big threat is what we call conflict over the boundaries of the political community. So democracy works well when the citizens of a nation broadly agree on who is a member and what their status is. If there's an unresolved formative rift in the nation's founding over who is included, it can reemerge as a source of trouble again and again, whether it's over race, ethnicity, or gender, or what have you. In the periods that we examine, battles over race take center stage, especially concerning those who are most overtly excluded in the nation's founding, African Americans. The third threat is rising economic inequality. Places where inequality is high and growing are more likely to suffer democratic deterioration. The question is why? I assumed going into this, the idea was that the 99% would rise up and have a revolution, but it's actually the opposite of that. When you have high inequality, the affluent become worried that the masses will impose redistributive policies and higher taxes. So to protect their interests, they seek to solidify their power, and they're willing to support repressive measures to do so if that's what it takes. Finally, the fourth threat is what we call executive aggrandizement. And this refers to the enlargement and concentration of powers of the nation's top leader in the United States, of course, the president. And the demise of checks and balances that can come with that, making a nation more prone to tyranny. Okay, now stepping back, all four of these threats have waxed and waned and combined in different ways in American history. In the period I was describing earlier, the 1790s, only one of them was unleashed, and that was political polarization, and acting all by itself, it created a lot of havoc. But by the 1850s, three threats converged, and by the end of the decade, it led to the onset of the Civil War. Then again in the 1890s, those same three threats converged. And I want to talk about the 1890s for a few minutes. In the decades following the Civil War, democracy for those who had rights to participate was quite vibrant. And this now included African-American men in the South who'd gained voting rights and were participating at high rates in elections and running for office, primarily as Republicans. Also, the People's Party emerged in 1892 out of the agrarian populist movement. And it also began to run candidates quite successfully. But at that very juncture, democracy was thrown into crisis. I want to zoom into North Carolina in the 1890s. There, Republicans and populists noticed that if they joined forces, running candidates on what was called a fusionist ballot, they stood a chance of beating the Democrats, who at that time in the South was the party run by white elites. And that's what they did. So in 1896, the fusionists managed to elect Republicans as governor and the majority of the state seats in the US House of Representatives and the state assembly. Democrats' worst fears had come to pass, and they plotted their way back to power. In 1898, they staged a coup d'etat in the city of Wilmington. It was the state's largest urban area, and it was a success story. African Americans were moving into the middle class. Three members of the Board of Aldermen were Black, as were numerous public sector employees. The Daily Record was a Black-owned newspaper, and as a daily, it was the only one of its kind in the nation. So democracy seemed to be on the rise. But on the morning of November 10th, nearly 2,000 white men who belonged to paramilitary groups gathered at the city armory. They marched to the offices of the Daily Record, set the building on fire, and watched it burn. Then they advanced through Black neighborhoods and murdered hundreds of residents. They dragged prominent people from their homes and took them to the train station and made them leave town. Before the day was out, the coup leaders at gunpoint forced the resignations of the mayor and aldermen and installed their own in their place. A few months later, the Democrats' party leaders statewide took measures to make their power permanent. They scaled back voting rights by establishing poll taxes and literacy tests. As one Democrat who was a state senator put it, he favored, quote, a good, square, honest law that will always give us a good Democratic majority, end quote. What happened in North Carolina brought out into the open a major transformation that occurred during that decade more quietly all over the South, as white elites shut down the political opposition. The federal government, meanwhile, including Republican presidents, permitted this. In 1898, President McKinley heard the pleas of African Americans in Wilmington asking for help, but failed to intervene. As disenfranchisement happened in state after state, President Theodore Roosevelt simply watched. Then President Taft went so far as to praise the restrictive rules for excluding what he called, quote, an ignorant, irresponsible element from the electorate. By the end of the 1890s, all four pillars of democracy had suffered harm. The main result was the disenfranchisement of millions of Black men and some poor whites. And once African Americans lost political power, they subsequently lost their civil liberties and civil rights as well. Jim Crow was established, and it lasted 60 years. And while Southern elites regained extra political power, not only to rule in their own states as autocrats, but also to exercise an outsized voice in national politics for the next half century. The politics of the 1890s reverberates in our own times. Then as now, we witness a high degree of polarization and rising economic inequality, both of which have been on the rise for decades now. Some political leaders use conflict over who belongs in the form of race baiting and ethnocentrism to fuel anger and promote political participation among white supporters, and threats combine with each other in dangerous ways. In fact, unlike in any of the earlier periods that we study in the book, today all four threats are raging at high levels. That's because over the 20th century, the executive power of the presidency grew tremendously. It grew because Americans wanted presidents to have the capacity to respond to public problems and attend to national security. Yet those powers create opportunities for abuse by presidents who would use them for their own personal or political gain. We saw that in Watergate, a time when actually the other three threats were at much lower levels. And we've seen it again in the last 4 years. So the rise of the four threats long predated President Trump, but he has intensified them, using the powers of the presidency to create larger political divisions, to fuel conflict over who belongs, and to cater to the most affluent. Those threats have taken on a life of their own, and they will continue to wreak havoc once he departs from public life. American history reveals that we can't take democracy for granted. It has been fragile time and again, and now is another such time. The questions for Americans must be how to make the preservation and restoration of democracy our first priority so that we can pass it on to future generations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Suzanne Mettler. We're talking about Professor Mettler's new book with Robert Lieberman, Four Threats. And I have to say, it's a terrific read. If you are a history buff, this is a book for you. It's one of those kind of special books that takes you from the beginning of the Republic right up to today. There are not a lot of books like that. I wouldn't describe it as uplifting, but there's just tons of fascinating research and actually terrific pictures. I don't know where you dug up some of those photos, but they're really quite riveting. You know, this is a book about kind of the risks that we have about the erosion of our democracy. And I'm curious your take on what has just happened. And I want to dig in a little bit more because I look at the 2020 election, and to me, it looks like a pretty positive sign, minus what's happening at the current moment. But as you said, record voting, you know, perhaps 65% will be the highest since 1908. We've seen, you know, tremendous engagement of both political parties. It was peaceful. We saw professional election officials doing their job. There wasn't this kind of collapse of the rule of law. We're seeing courts, for the most part, following the rule of law as they take on some of the challenges by President Trump. The network, CNN, Fox, they've behaved, I would say, in a fairly responsible, consistent way. I don't see infringement on press freedoms. And so I look at that, and to me, what I'm seeing is some of that polarization loosened a bit. Joe Biden did very well in suburban areas, particularly among women, among folks who had voted in the past with Republicans. Participation by people of color was significant and very decisive, but not necessarily in predictable directions. We see different results with Latino and Hispanic voters in Florida versus Arizona and Nevada. Donald Trump has done his best to undermine this. And yet he's, you know, he's not succeeding. It looks as if, you know, his hand is being played out, and there are all indications the election will be declared and for Joe Biden, and he'll be inaugurated. So is that, you know, kind of a correction to this kind of dire picture that you're presenting about democracy?
Well, I agree with everything that you're saying. And I think, you know, it's extraordinary, frankly, that in the midst of a pandemic, we had the highest voter turnout since we had in the early 20th century. I mean, that's extraordinary. And, you know, it is just a testament to all the Americans who found ways to vote this time around. But, you know, that's part of the story. But there were also so many things going on over the past 6 months by President Trump and by members of his party to try to discourage voting, to try to make it harder to vote, you know, slowing down the mail service in the midst of an election, trying to discourage people from mail-in voting and associating it with fraud again and again. And now that we are through the election, for the president still to have failed to concede the election to Biden, and to the contrary, doing everything he can, and with the assistance of other Republican officials who are trying to lean on the state and local officials and to urge them to not abide by the law and principles of how we are doing things. And so, you know, I mean, there's so many examples of this, so I won't list them at length, but, you know, for example, we have the Secretary of State of Georgia, who Senator Lindsey Graham called him and, you know, tried to get him to throw out the votes in lots of counties. Fortunately, this is a man with a North Star, and he's refusing to do that. But what if he wasn't? We have, you know, Wayne County in Michigan, where there's been a conflict over whether to certify the ballots. And President Trump himself called one of the Republicans who is responsible for that, trying to pressure her not to do so. So, you know, this continues at all levels. So what I see is two broad problems going on. One is that, and this well predates this year. I mean, frankly, since Trump came on the scene as a candidate in 2015 and 2016, he has worked to delegitimize American elections and to say that they are permeated by fraud. And it's very striking to me, if you look at polling data going back just a couple of years before that, the vast majority of Americans of both parties agreed that we could trust our election results in the United States. And that's no longer true. And, you know, we're coming out of this election now, it's over 70% of Republicans think that the election wasn't fair and that Biden won because of fraud. That's very problematic. It's problematic for the legitimacy of government, most fundamentally. I mean, it will also make it difficult for Biden to govern and to solve broad public problems that most Americans are worried about, regardless of their party. And it's problematic for where do we go from here? I mean, we have so many big issues to try to deal with as a country, but this is just going to be leading to a lot more dysfunction. And it worries me that then with subsequent elections, if we don't have state and local officials running them who are as conscientious as some of these individuals that I've been mentioning, that they will do what their party wants instead of just upholding the results of the election.
I think everything you've said is very important and something we need to keep in mind. And yet I come back to the point I was making about the system of laws and procedures. Everything you've said is a warning sign, but it's also the case that the system is working. It has worked. People voted peacefully. Their votes have been counted. And you can, you know, kind of create a horizon of worry. But in the present, people voted in record numbers. We saw the election process, the officials, secretary of states in blue and red states doing their jobs. We're seeing courts again and again following the law. We've seen the media using its power as protected under the Constitution, I would say in a fairly judicious manner in calling out the president. So I think, you know, for me, the issue here is less about the horizon and more about democratic procedures and the system itself, which I think by your own account, at the moment, it is working. It is, we haven't seen the suspension of free press. We haven't seen the kind of draconian 1890s North Carolina scenario breaking out.
Yeah. Well, what I would say, and this is, you know, what I really learned from working with the scholars who study countries around the world, is that we shouldn't be waiting for the moment where there are tanks in the streets and when, you know, the president disbands Congress or something to that effect, something dramatic that we associate with, okay, now democracy is lost. That it has tended to be the case in countries around the world in the past few decades, that it happens more gradually and partially. And I would say if we look at those four pillars of democracy that I mentioned, we are already seeing real deterioration, particularly with free and fair elections for reasons I've been mentioning, and the rule of law and the legitimacy of the opposition. So what I mean about the rule of law is that, you know, in the past 4 years, the department, if you think of the Department of Justice, first Jeff Sessions was the attorney general, and he was dismissed by Trump until he found someone who was willing to do his bidding for him, William Barr. And he's been treating the Department of Justice as if it's his own personal law firm, there to protect him on all sorts of things, ranging from, you know, dealing with the emoluments to lawsuits that are brought forward against him to issues about the election. And so, you know, to say the system is working, I would say, you know, it's managing, but there is a lot of deterioration going on. And that's a big concern to me.
When you say rule of law, does the fact that we're seeing courts in multiple states rule against these, factless cases brought by President Trump, and these include judges who were appointed right. by Republicans, does that have any bearing in your assessment of rule of law?
That's absolutely very reassuring. Okay, but it is disturbing that that Barr himself permitted, encouraged bringing forward these lawsuits, most of which don't have a leg to stand on.
And we've seen U.S. attorneys push back very hard right. on that yes. order. Yes. I mean, to me, it seems like again, the procedures and the rules are being followed. I'm not disputing, you know, the level of angst that that you detect as reasonable. It just seems to me we need to be clear about, you know, the system itself versus these warning signs that you see about a future that looks more dire to you.
Yeah, I would say it's not just warning signs of the future that we're actually seeing crumbling now. And so, you know, I do this by, you know, keeping track of each of these four pillars, and when events happen, thinking about, well, is this just a threat to this pillar, or is it actually danger? And there's been an accumulation of, or is it actually causing crumbling rather? And there's been an accumulation of deterioration over the past few months. And, you know, I think what really leads to this is the raging of these four threats, and polarization being very strong, so that people are willing to look the other way. They want to win at all costs, never mind what happens to these pillars of democracy.
Let me go, this terrific book that you've written, Four Threats, we're talking with Suzanne Mettler. It has a terrific chapter on the Watergate crisis in the 70s, and then it kind of jumps to the current era. And it's interesting, that half century, I would say, is quite remarkable, because it is a period of enduring nonstop constitutional disputes. You've got Ronald Reagan, who used executive orders in ways presidents hadn't used in the past. The crisis culminates with the Iran-Contra affair, in which the presidents, the White House, boldly disregarded a law to pursue a foreign policy it wanted, and was very eventually open about saying the president can ignore law because his power is plenary in the area of foreign affairs. Then you move to, well, obviously George W. Bush, there were concerns about spying, about torture that was forbidden by law, and Congress felt violated the Constitution. Barack Obama expanded drones. There was no declaration of war to do that. In the conservative press, there's great concern that under President Obama, the IRS pursued and harassed the Tea Party to the point that its ability to engage in the political process crumbled and may have contributed to election defeats in 2012, which was a close outcome. Now, I put all that together and I'm looking at data about trust in government. And here's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing when there's a Democrat in the White House, the trust of Democrats is high and the trust of Republicans is low, which is the case we saw with both Clinton and Obama. The Democrats under Clinton and Obama thought the president was doing a great job. They're very confident. When you have Republicans in the White House, it's the reverse. You've got Republicans who are confident. So my question to you is, are our perceptions about Democratic demise partisan? Are we filtering this through what we see as something that's hideous, whereas, you know, lots of Republicans think the president is following the law, is following the Constitution?
Yeah, great question. So so the power of the presidency has, of course, been growing since the 1930s. And, you know, came about very much to, you know, initially to respond to the Great Depression, very high unemployment rates, and then World War II, national security, and then on it goes. And so presidents of both parties have grown these powers, and Congress has given a lot of extra authority to presidents over time, really ceded it to presidents over time. So each president comes along acquiring more power than the president before them, typically. And what we've seen, you know, I think like when you're mentioning like the 1980s, looking back to the 1980s now, and I was like working in Washington some of those years, and, you know, things were so mild by comparison to now, in that partisanship was much lower It was, you know, really just starting to increase, just starting to rise. There've been these, you know, changes at the grassroots level in people's party affiliation and a gradual sorting out that emerged from the 1960s onward. And by the 1980s, elections are becoming much more competitive because in any given election, Congress could change hands between the parties. The Republican Party was becoming much more competitive than it had been against the Democrats. And so so then the public officials in each are trying to distinguish themselves from each other rather than to engage in policymaking. And that just, you know, becomes more intense by the 1990s and the early 2000s and so on. But then what begins to happen, and what I think you're putting your finger on, is that presidents use this growing executive power to cater to public, to political parties and to party activists. And presidents, again, of both parties do that. And trying to, especially when, you know, polarization makes it harder for Congress to act on big public priorities. So then presidents feel like they've got to get something done. They've got to convince their base they've done something. So they use those executive powers of the administrative state to accomplish things that they can't otherwise. And both Democrats and Republicans do this. So, you know, I agree with you that, you know, we do know that people's perceptions of this are partisan now, but I think it's emerged through that dynamic.
Let's move past the inauguration on January 20th. There's a President Biden, he puts in a new attorney general. Will we revert to, you know, kind of a lower level in your continuum of kind of dire threat to democracy to everything's okay? Will things recalibrate under President Biden?
So I do think that that the future President-elect Biden will, you know, for those concerns I have about the rule of law, I think we're going to be in a better position in that he will staff the Department of Justice with people who are very conscientious about the rule of law. And I think, you know, that will help tremendously. But I think that these four threats, you know, I've been talking some about President Donald Trump, but, you know, he did not create these threats. They long predate him. They led to his emergence as a candidate and helped him to get elected, we argue. And once he is gone from public life, they will continue to rage. They've been very much, they've taken on a life of their own. And you can't stuff that genie back in the bottle. I mean, it's really hard, I think, as, you know, we political scientists know that once these things are unleashed, you cannot easily rein them in. And so the great effort needs to be to strengthen the four pillars of democracy. And, you know, I would strongly encourage President Biden to be promoting legislation that will do that. It's, of course, going to be challenging because of polarization. It's going to be very challenging to accomplish those kinds of things.
Just picking up on this question, we've got this theme. We have a question here saying, this is the question, it's an anonymous attendee. Presentation seems quite biased. The true threat from to American democracy appears to be socialism.
I don't think so. I think, you know, when you look across the American political spectrum, you know, the question is how much of a role do we want government to have to help to promote the economy, to promote economic growth and to regulate the economy, to rein in excesses of capitalism. And, you know, I think that Americans have long been on, you know, on a spectrum from wanting less of that kind of intervention to more of that kind of intervention, and that it's really not helpful to use the term socialism, because, you know, we're really just talking about the degree of that kind of intervention that we'd like government to do.
Thank you. You talked in your presentation about the diminishment of the rights of people of color, particularly Black Americans, both to vote and participate and engage more broadly. Does the participation of African Americans, Latinos, and Asians in this election, and particularly there's, you know, decisive influence in a number of congressional presidential races in states, does that suggest a kind of a more positive development in terms of that threat of exclusion?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's terrific to have high voter participation across the board, and it's excellent to have high participation by people of color exercising their voice and making a big difference in the election. It's also, it's very interesting that there were many Latinos, both in Florida and along the Texas border, who voted for President Donald Trump. And I actually think that's a good thing, that should be welcomed, because the Republican Party, as the two parties have become more polarized in recent years, one of the underlying dynamics has been that, you know, the US population has grown more diverse, and the Democratic Party has also diversified considerably and kind of kept up with that, the change in the US population, whereas the Republican Party has changed less and stayed more of a white party. And that has all kinds of effects that are problematic in a society that's really a broad, multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial society. How can we have a democracy that is as well? And so I think that's a positive development for the Republican Party.
You talk about the rise of presidential power. Dick Cheney, who was a member of Congress during the Iran-Contra affair, was on the committee, the congressional committee, and wrote the minority report. This was the beginning of the so-called unitary presidency account, which argues that circumstances, dire circumstances, require the president to take unilateral action, particularly when security is at stake. So I'm curious, does the reason or the circumstances facing a president impact your view about executive power? For instance, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War and took other extraordinary measures. Was he, killing democracy, or was he defending it? Today, we've got all sorts of threats, cyber threats, germ warfare threats, terrorist threats. Are those circumstances in which we would say defending democracy means the president ought to be acting unilaterally?
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the argument that's made, right? But I don't buy it. I think that in the founding of this country, Congress is established as the first branch. And it's the branch that epitomizes representative government, and it's the closest to the people and most accountable to the people. The presidency, the executive branch, have much more constrained powers. I think, absolutely it's been appropriate for those to have been increased over time so that presidents can respond, broadly speaking, but I think to broad public needs. But I think we need to be very careful. You know, it's always possible to justify these things, but we need to think long and hard about it, because, that is how you move toward tyranny.
There are a cluster of questions here that that reflect the one I'm going to read now. If it's as bad as you say, isn't it already too late?
No, it's not too late. Why am I saying that? Maybe simply because I'm an optimist. But no, it's not too late. And frankly, all of these positive things that you were mentioning about the recent election are a testament to that you know, people were so involved, even in the midst of a pandemic. I do think that when, you know, it's heartening to me on the one hand that when, you know, even just like a few years ago, when Americans were asked whether they believed in all of these specific pillars of democracy, both Democrats and Republicans did at high rates. But that's been fraying and becoming more aligned with partisanship. And, you know, it depends upon which political actor is doing what, whether people, how people will respond now. But I think that so much cannot be lost already that we can't repair it.
Okay, here's a follow-up question from Jim Hart, who's a distinguished colleague here at the University of Minnesota. Of the four threats, which should Joe Biden attack first and with the most vigor?
Well, you know, I actually, the argument we make in the end of the book is that attacking the threats is really hard because of the way that they become unleashed, and that the more prudent thing to do, the more low-hanging fruit to go after is strengthening those pillars of democracy, free and fair elections, the rule of law, et cetera. You know, with the threats, I know that that President-elect Biden will try to rein in polarization. And if anyone can, he's probably the right person to do it, but I still think that's probably unlikely for that to be very possible. But what he will not do as a president, and I, you know, feel quite confident of this, is he is not going to be trying to combine conflict over who belongs with polarization, which is, you know, what has been going on in recent years and is so detrimental. And I think he is going to be trying to promote policies that lessen economic inequality. So so that's also very positive.
I was surprised in reading the book, there's not a lot in it about the US Constitution. And often books about American democracy will have a kind of backbone that's made up of the Constitution. And there are a lot of ways in which people have thought about the Constitution and democracy, obviously, in spelling out the rules of the game and stipulating in writing rights that we all have as citizens. But also the Constitution tends to shape the language we use in describing our battles over politics. It also shapes where we have battles. I was in the United Kingdom for most of a year, and Boris Johnson was doing things that were unprecedented. They don't have a written constitution. There wasn't, you know, this sense of constitutional crisis in the way that we think about it, you know, executive power. It was defined in more partisan terms and more personal terms about Boris Johnson. What is your thinking about the independent role of the Constitution in thinking about American democracy?
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely the Constitution structures the way we carry out democracy. But I think in terms of the Constitution protecting democracy when there's a lot of threats against it, it doesn't protect us all by itself. And that's what we found in each of the periods that we looked at. You know, certainly the Constitution fragments powers in lots of ways, but and it can seem that it protects us in a period like when we were growing up and when the threats were at much lower levels. But then once the threats are raging and the political system becomes vulnerable, the Constitution can't protect us by itself. It takes people who exercise their agency to protect democracy. And so, you know, that would be my major point. It also, you know, the Constitution, because it fragments power in so many ways, in order for us to accomplish things in the United States, to create policies that address major public problems, you need to build big coalitions to do that. You can't do it otherwise. It just doesn't work. And so polarization makes that very difficult. And as that's been happening in recent decades, polarization rising, more difficult for Congress to govern, then I think you get the emergence of anti-government attitudes because people, regardless of their partisanship, they feel like government's not responding to them. But the other issue is that polarization makes it easier for one party, if it behaves very strategically, to stack the deck against the other. And that's hard to do in the United States, given our US Constitution, but it's possible. And I think we've been seeing a lot of that going on.
Follow-up question here from one of our friends in the audience who notes that many of the steps that Joe Biden might take would require executive orders and other prerogatives by the president. Won't this simply contribute and perhaps further accelerate the very strain on American democracy that you've described?
Yeah. Well, I do think that, I think that's a good question to raise, and I have that concern. And what Biden can do initially in ways that will strengthen American democracy is, for one thing, very simple things like projecting the values of democracy, trying to unify Americans rather than to divide Americans. And then staffing up the federal bureaucracy with people who are very competent and who take the rule of law seriously. All of that will help. And all of that is without using extraordinary executive power. Now, beyond that, you know, we can hope that Congress will work with him and that he will be able to build some, and that Democrats will be able to build coalitions with Republicans to accomplish some major things. If that doesn't happen, he will likely use more executive orders and that kind of thing. And it's not what I like to see, but that is where we are. It's where, you know, President Obama, during his first 2 years as president, had, these very large Democratic majorities. It was actually, if you go all the way back to 1980, there have only been these large Democratic majorities in both chambers during the early Clinton term and the early Obama term. And there were only 4 months since 1980 when a Democratic president had both those things and a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. It's because of that the Affordable Care Act was enacted and some of the other achievements of the Obama presidency. But then once the Democrats did very poorly in the 2010 election with the resurgence of the Republicans and the rise of the Tea Party, then Obama said to his staff, okay, we've got to push the envelope and see what we can do through executive power. And this was a president who had, when he was running for office, said he disapproved of that kind of thing. It's what presidents do now when they can't get things done through Congress. And I'm sad to say that.
Jeffrey Arnold asked, George Washington warned about the rise of political parties. Have we gone too far in terms of our political parties? And does it make sense for us to reverse this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And of course, George Washington, I gained a very different view of him in writing this book. I think we always revere him. It turns out that Washington himself was horrified by active citizens who were forming what were called the Democratic Republican Societies. And these were these groups of men in many different states that were trying to simply educate themselves on public issues and speak out in between elections about them. And George Washington was horrified. And he would say, we're only supposed to hear from citizens at election time, not in between. The Federalists, of which he was one, really helped to drive polarization in that time. So we can't be too, use rose-colored glasses to look at the past. But looking at the present and parties, it's really interesting because obviously parties are very strong today when we look at Congress and what's going on in Congress, and they're very strong, and elected officials, and they're very strong in terms of, we all know lots of people who identify as either Democrats or Republicans, and for whom that's a very strong identity. But parties, the other level of parties, which is organizations at the grassroots level, they're very weak. And I think that's actually a source of some of our problems today, is that we have a strong partisanship and weak parties. And this idea comes from another political scientist, Julia Azari. And I think that's problematic, because then the parties are not in good touch with local people. And they can become driven by activists who tend to have more extreme views than people at the grassroots.
Does it make sense then to elevate the visibility and viability of other political parties other than the Democratic and Republican parties?
Well, you know, it could be that it is time. You know, it's several times in American history, the parties have transformed themselves. It's given our political system of winner-take-all elections and single-member districts, it doesn't work well to be a third party. You just become a spoiler and you don't have a chance of winning. Although sometimes third parties have transformed themselves into one of the two major parties. And certainly when I was talking about the Democrats and Republicans of, you know, the last century, it was probably confusing to people because they've changed so much since then. So, you know, it could be that it's a time for some of that kind of transformation. But given our rules of the game, we really are a two-party system.
In your description of democracy, free press is a prominent part of it. Mm-hmm. We do see today that social media is spewing out misinformation, conspiracy theories. It's helping to propel the polarization, some of the other negative effects that you've discussed. Is there a case for looking at ways for restricting, in some respects, the freedom of the press?
Wow. You know, one of the themes that was really striking to my co-author, Robert Lieberman, and I was how the press has been a major actor since the very beginning. So, you know, you go back to the early 1790s and you had some of the founding fathers were the creators of our first partisan press, truly partisan press. They were publishing, and you know, anyone who's seen the musical Hamilton has gotten a taste of this. They were publishing what we might call anonymous op-eds and against, and you know, saying terrible things about each other in print. And again, in each of our periods, the press plays a major role. I don't think that you know, heavy regulation of the press is a good idea, and freedom of the press is really important in the United States. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing today is, on the one hand, there are some real concerns about very partisan media and people's ability to sift through information that they receive and social media to sort it out for what's fact-based and what's not. At the same time, I think that the media, which has, you know, really diversified over time, has been characterized by very high standards in this period, and that it has been a bulwark of democracy.
But including the social media world?
Well, you know, I am concerned about the social media world and, yeah, you know, how to go about that. I'm not the expert on that. Probably, Larry, you have a lot more thoughts about this than I do as a scholar of the media.
So I got two last things I want to ask you about, or one last question, which is, it's striking that you describe kind of this almost like a downward arc in democracy, or an arc in which it's very problematic all the way along the line. Because I would say, you know, whether the launching of the country was democratic or not was a big question. In the 1770s and 80s, you had real democracy in the States, and the reaction of Madison and the other group, others who got together in Philadelphia in 1787 was to contain it, to restrict it. It's why we get the Electoral College. So do you think in some extent the problems of our democracy stems from its problematic origins?
I do and I don't. I mean, I think that democracy has become more robust over time. And most of my work up until this book was really about the arc of democratization in the United States, and, you know, which I think has become much more democratic over time and you know, really becomes a full democracy by the 1960s and 1970s. But you know, I do think this idea of the formative rift, that if you have people who are really excluded in the nation's founding, that that can create a problem for democracy again and again, and how that happened in the United States around race is a really fundamental issue that we need to continue to grapple with.
Can you hold on 1 second? I want to just make a few announcements and then talk about your book again. I want to just let you know, we got some great events coming up next week. We have a terrific program on polling in 2020. Includes renowned political science professor at Columbia University, Robert Shapiro, and it also includes Kathy Frankovich, who used to run polling for CBS News in New York. Then we have Jake Sullivan coming in on Wednesday. Jake is going to be talking about the Biden foreign policy. Those of you who know Jake know that he comes from Minnesota. He's back here frequently. And then he's also in the inner circle in the Biden world. So we'll get some good insights on that. I'm really excited. We're going to take a break from some of the political world. We're going to have two terrific writers coming in December in separate events. Charles Baxter, who's a National Book Award finalist and a famous writer. He's going to be with us December 3rd. Later in the month, Newbery Prize winner Kate DiCamillo, who's famous in the kids world, will be also visiting with us. So a lot to look forward to. I want to thank you for joining us. I want to also let you know that right now there's Give to the Max Day, and please consider giving support for our center's program for policy fellows. It's a terrific program. It tries to do a lot of the things that Suzanne Mettler just mentioned. A recording of this event will be available within the next 24 hours. It'll be up on Zoom. It can also be captured on as a podcast. So there's great. I want to conclude though by thanking my good friend and esteemed colleague, Suzanne Mettler. Her book, I'd like to hold it up for you because you can see what a beautiful gift it would be for anyone you know who loves history, American history. Her terrific book, The Four Threats with Robert Lieberman. Professor Mettler, thank you so much for joining us and putting up with our questions.
Oh, I've really loved your questions. So thank you so much. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And finally, I want to thank Lee Chittenden, who is the magic for everything we do, and Natalie, who is a terrific graduate student at the Humphrey School and helps to make this possible. Thank you. Have a great day.